This is an ABC podcast.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
And great to have you along this afternoon, 12:05. And between now and the news at 1 o'clock, checking with news headlines at 12:30, off to the Weather Bureau then to check conditions right around Western Australia. Having a look at the Gubbinj harvest, taking you to the far, well, remote Kimberley coast, really, where the Gubbinj harvest has been, well, a little bit slow this time round, mainly due to seasonal conditions, so we'll check in there. And also talking about another possibility to the agricultural visa, having a look at the 400 visa and seeing if that might be tweaked a little bit to include agriculture as one of those skills necessary under that particular 400 visa. As always, your thoughts most welcome throughout the hour, 0448 922 604. Kicking off with the wool industry today, because the Australian Wool Exchange says overweight wool bales are costing growers a fortune and something needs to be done about it. The current minimum bale weight is 120 kilograms and the maximum bale weight is 204 kilograms. Now, AWEX says overweight bales are costing wool growers, this is right across Australia, up to $800,000 a year. And Western Australia is the worst offender. AWEX CEO is Mark Grave. Mark, how common is this practice across Australia?
Look, the pressing of overweight or even underweight bales is quite common and usually due to a number of different factors. The lack of scales in the shed, old equipment, but the fact is that the industry has had this issue in place for many years and it's time to make a change.
So what are the implications of that, especially if you're getting to that overweight end? What happens at that point?
Well, at the overweight end, if a bale comes in overweight, and you've got to understand that brokers don't know whether a bale coming off a truck is overweight or underweight, so they've got to weigh it straight away. And if it's a one bale, they don't know if it's one on a truck or it could be 10 or it could be 20. So it actually slows down the processing of wool. Now, if they have to make an adjustment, so take wool out, they may have to take out of one, two or three bales of wool of that particular line, it then slows down the process once more, and that wool is either repressed into another bale or it will often end up in bulk class, which usually attracts less competition.
So how is it costing growers, as I mentioned earlier, that $800,000 a year?
It really is about time, and time, as growers know, costs money. And to get the wool down to sale, and this is the problem, is that quite often we're making it someone else's problem. And if it's someone else's problem, then the whole industry has inefficiency and it's costing the industry. So conservatively, we on the figures that we have, approximately 2% nationally comes into the store overweight. But in WA, that figure doubles. It's closer to 4%. And even if you put a figure of $20 per bale, by the time you repack, recore, you have to get new wool pack, etc., it adds up to roughly $250,000 just in WA alone.
Why is that? Why is the situation that bad in Western Australia?
I think it's a lot to do with sheep profile. You know, pastoral clips sometimes carry a bit more dust and are a bit heavier. The real point here is that we could all do better and we will all benefit if we all do better. So the aim here is to create awareness around it, make people aware, not just the growers, but the contract teams, the shearers, the classes, the presses, that there is actually an issue here that needs to be addressed, and hopefully together we'll work on it and improve what we're doing.
Why do we have these standard weights, that minimum of 120 kilograms and the maximum of 204 kilograms?
Well, it's about efficiencies in the industry. A lot of the machinery that's being used, not just the forklifts, there are dumps that press wool that goes into containers. There are core machines that actually sample each particular bale are geared to a maximum of, or engineered to a maximum of 204 kilograms. Now, I know growers are aware you can press more than that, but the machinery isn't engineered to actually take more than that. So it causes injury, potential injury. It causes breakdowns further down the line, and that means that there's additional costs that the industry has to be prepared for.
If that maximum was allowed to be increased, wouldn't that naturally increase other efficiencies throughout the system?
Yeah, look, that's a fair observation. I think the problem with that is, as I said, a lot of the machinery is only geared and engineered to 204. We recently increased the minimum from 110 to 120 kilograms, and again, trying to get more weight in the bales, but equally create more efficiency. But once we, and we review this quite often, but once we go over 204, and growers might think, or contractors might think, that it's only 1 kilogram or 5 kilograms, but you really have to work out exactly what you do with the excess wool and whether it affects one, two, or all bales in a particular line. So that moment of doubt, that rehandling of wool, creates the inefficiency that costs the industry dealing.
You mentioned the scales earlier, and I guess that's, you know, a lot of where things might be falling down if they're not quite accurate. How much do those scales cost that are measuring that weight of each bale?
Well, I think it's important to know that, number one, we're very good as an industry in making machinery last as long as it possibly can. We want to get the best bang for buck out of what we invest in. So there are a lot of wool presses that would be well in excess of 20 years old, well in excess of 40 years old, that still exist today and are still operational. But they don't all, and most of those won't have scales attached to them. Now, when you're dealing with heavy objects, that becomes a work health safety issue, particularly when it comes to road rules, road regulations, and handling that wool. With wool at the value that it is today, I don't think there's any reason why any farm, any shed, shouldn't have a functional pair of scales that they can test and can weigh bales on.
So do you believe that's where things are falling down with those scales?
Well, it starts at the shed. So if we get it right at the shed, it's the same with wool classing, it's the same with any type of wool preparation and documentation, descriptions, branding of the wool. If we get it right at the shed, then that transpires to being right throughout the supply chain. If we get it wrong at the shed, then somebody either has to fix up the problem or that error goes further through the supply chain that we have to try and address.
And is AWACS prepared to crack down on repeat offenders?
Well, we're working together with brokers because they are the first receival point, and we're actively working with them to get more information about overweight bales and adjustments, and contacting the classes concerned to make them aware of the problem. So the first point of call really is to find out exactly the situation, the state of play, find out where it is occurring, and speak to those that may be doing it unknowingly. I'm not suggesting that this is malicious in any way, shape or form, but I think as an industry we can get better.
So it might just be that people are totally unaware that this is happening.
Yeah. I mean,
do they get the records back to say that the certain bales were overweight?
Probably not. The information is that is the grower's information, but working with the brokers, we will be able to contact the classes concerned and make them aware. They will speak to their shearing teams, they will speak to their presses, and in with the broker, you know, we hope that they will also speak to the growers so that they are aware of the issue as well.
Mark Grave, good to have you on the WA Country Hour. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mark Grave, he's the CEO of the Australian Wool Exchange, and AWACS saying that overweight wool bales are costing growers a fortune, around about $800,000 a year right across Australia. But as you just heard Mark saying, the situation worse here in Western Australia, double what's going on around the rest of the country. I think he said 2% for right across Australia, but 4% of what's handed in overweight here in Western Australia.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
Mick says, soft dudes, if a bale weighs X amount of weight, then it should be sold at that weight, says Mick. And also this through from Callum in Katanning. Does it really matter if they're overweight? The maximum weight goes back to the days of manual handling. Forklifts are here now, says Callum in Katanning. 0448 922 604 to have your say on the Country Hour today, 12:15. Danny Burkett is State Wool Manager at Elders. Danny, what have you seen? You've been around for a while in the wool industry. How common is this practice in your experience?
It's very common in WA, overweight bales. The maximum weight is 204. The vast majority of overweight bales would be pressed up to roughly 210 kilos. It's no different to me sitting in a Ford Ranger that has, 200 k's on the clock and a speed limit of 110 on the road. So we have machinery and sheds that can press up over 204 kilos. But that text that you did receive, it goes back to the manual handling days when we had a barra and bale hook and we manhandled each bale. Union rules stated nothing over 204 kilos, but that's the state of play that we sit in today.
So you, we were just hearing from Mark Grave. He was saying that the machinery it can handle it, but it's not really calibrated to do that work. So it's got to be a standard right across the board. Do you think that standard might need to be tweaked a little?
Well, I look at a simple scenario. If we were to lift the bale weight, we just increase efficiencies straight up. I look at a grower, we'd pay less, he'd have less packs, less transport costs because you'd have less bales if he's pressing up heavy. As a broker, it'd less floor space for myself in storing wool, less cost for the actual exporter who's purchased and pays on a per bale rate to get that wool moved from store. I look again at the exporter who's putting that bale into a container if we can get more into each bale. I just see a simple tweaking of that maximum bale weight would be very beneficial in efficiencies across the whole chain in our industry.
And as Mark Grave was saying, Mark from AWEX was saying, it's something that does come up every now and again. It was only a couple of years ago that this was looked at, and that's when the minimum weight was increased at that point. Why is it so difficult, do you think, to make that adjustment at the other end of the scale, at the maximum weight?
I don't know the rules and regs and the engineering of the weights around these machinery, as in dumping machines and coring machines, etc., whether they are calibrated to 204 kilos. I'm not aware of that, but if we were to make new machinery that goes on into the future, it would be lovely to think that it could handle a bale of more than 204 kilos.
What about the reasons that Western Australia is sort of getting that 4% of the bales coming in are actually hitting that overweight mark? And Mark was saying that it could be to do with the profile of the wool, with looking at the pastoral clip and maybe the extra dust included might be tipping the scales a little. Do you agree with that?
I'd probably suggest more around the nature and the competitiveness of brokers in this state, that not all brokers enforce. As Elders, we will charge a grower for an overweight bale simply because it does stall our process. We have to remove that wool, but not all brokers in this state actually charge for that function. And it's not an individual broker that should be making that choice. This is an industry standard that all brokers should be charging for an overweight. I mean, I'm not suggesting that 204 kilos is the weight that it should be, but they're the rules that we're playing within. It's not an individual broker decision to be making. It's an industry standard. So I think that the competitive nature of our business, number one, in affecting bale weights, and number two, I totally agree with what Mark said. A lot of these bales are pressed up totally unaware by the presser because they're looking at scales that are wrong. And for a small outlay, I'm sure you can get your hands on some electronic scales that you can actually check the weight of the two bales that come out to ensure that what you're working with is true and correct.
So what have you seen around the traps then with those scales? Mark was saying that some of them could be over 20 years old.
Absolutely, without a doubt, and more. And unfortunately, growers and contractors, classes and presses are relying on those weights. And as I said, for a simple outlay, electronic scales, weigh the first couple of bales, work out where your scales are wrong, adjust them up or down. Or even if they're out 5 kilos, you know that straight up by electronic scale and you can press accordingly.
And how important do you think is it to address that situation, and especially what's going on here in WA, because sort of repeat offenders by the looks of things here in WA with the figures comparing to what's going on around the rest of the country. Do you think it's an important issue that needs to be addressed, even though you might like that weight, that maximum weight to be increased? It is what it is right now. Do you think it's important to reach that maximum level and not go over it.
Absolutely, and we're involved with AWEX trying to stop this issue, because it's a huge problem for each broker having to stop equipment to adjust the weight of bales to 204 kilos or below. So, yeah, absolutely agree with Mark Grave. It is a huge problem, and we are absolutely united with AWEX in trying to stop this by making contractors and classes aware that they are pressing out overweight bales, so that the next shed they go to, they can be more cautious and vigilant around those weights.
Danny, can you help us out with this text through from Michael in Bridgetown? He says, if you have a 230 kilograms of wool with a minimum weight of 120 kilograms, how do you get to sell the wool? Too light for two bales, too heavy for one bale.
Absolutely correct, and that's the issue that we look at. We have to, you either send that through a lot building system where your wool will be sold with other growers willing to share a test result. Once that's sold, you're paid out on the weight that you have actually contributed to that particular line. But that is exactly the issue that this maximum minimum bar weights create. But we do have to have the maximum minimum bar weights. The minimum bar weight is an issue in itself. To try and actually grab a bar to extract the sample of wool from 110 kilos is very difficult, because you can imagine the pack is very soft. And as the blade tries to cut the pack, it just simply pushes the pack down. You end up with a lot of fibre from the pack in the sample, because it's very difficult to extract that wool sample.
Well, it's a lot of money when you're talking about $800,000, the cost of those overweight bales to the system, the wool selling system. And even when you break that down, $250,000 here in Western Australia, that's better off in wool growers' hands, really, isn't it?
Every cent's worthwhile back in the grower's hand to continue to grow merino wool or sand wool or whatever takes your fancy, but you're dead right. That's more valid back in the grower's pocket. And against my very grain of my being, I would love to see an industry standard, a minimum fine, if you like, for anybody that does press an overweight bale up, because that would eradicate the problem very quickly when you speak to the hip pocket.
But I'd like that
enforced across all brokers, without any broker slipping through the net as such.
Danny, great to have you on the Country Hour. We're catching up on Friday. We'll go through the wool market with you then.
Talk then.
Thanks so much. Danny Burkett is the State Wool Manager at Elders, and this afternoon talking about these overweight wool bales. There are standards for the bales: the minimum weight 120 kilograms, the maximum bale weight 204 kilograms. Western Australia very often over that maximum bale weight, more so than the rest of Australia, and costing growers right across the country up to $800,000 a year. 0448 922 604 if you'd like to be part of the conversation this afternoon. ABC WA, it's 22 past 12.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, there are calls from farmers and recruitment agencies for the government to make three-month short-stay visas applicable to agriculture. The 400 visa is a repeat visa that allows foreign workers to work in this country for 3 to 6 months if you have specialised skills, knowledge or experience that is not generally available in Australia. It's not considered an agricultural visa, but farmers say if it was, it would be a huge benefit to the industry. Lee Webster runs Farm Work Recruitment Agency to Work in Oz and says finding labour during harvest can be very challenging, but finding experienced labourers is even more challenging.
I get regular requests from young farmers who are coming in from overseas that would like to come and do harvest and seeding and then go home in between times because they have work at home. And our farmers don't need, like there's a lot of farms that don't need full-time staff, so they can't offer, you know, local people consistent work, and their towns aren't big enough to support that seasonal demand anyway. So, yeah, definitely at the moment, skilled farmers from overseas can really do two harvests and two seedings under the working holiday visa arrangements. And that's enough for them to get, you know, some experience, but the farmers don't get the benefit of those skills. If they could come, a lot of them would probably come back for maybe up to 5 years, and then they're skilled and they're ready to settle down.
Is experience
particularly needed as well in agriculture?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think looking when I went through that application process for my client, there was an emphasis on, you know, university degrees, and, you know, that was accepted and recognised. But an agricultural university degree does not give someone the competency level to operate, you know, $800,000-$900,000 combine harvester. So I think that sort of experience, that sort of skill comes from experience, practical experience, not theoretical experience. That's what they don't recognise.
You mentioned one of the appealing things about that short stay visa is that, you know, it's a repeat visa. You can train them up and then they can come back for more than two seasons. The seasonal workers program with the Pacific Islanders, that also is a repeat visa. What's stopping everyone from just using that instead?
I think the main thing is the Pacific Islanders have a specific skill set. You tend to find them in the horticultural industry, like picking fruit and vegetables and packing. And they're not trained and educated with machinery and cropping and livestock, that cropping and livestock sector. So to bring them in and train them up is quite a big job. And they tend to like working in teams and families, and a lot of our industry requires you to work independently and individually. So it's just a different, a different culture and different skill set that we require people for. And there are, you know, other countries in the world that have people wanting to come to Australia who have the skills and have the interest in our part of the industry.
Just looking at the requirements to get this temporary work or short stay specialist visa, you must be invited or supported by the organisation that you're working for. You have to have specialist skills, knowledge or experience that can help Australian businesses, and you have to only do the work or activities for which your visa was granted. So why is it that doesn't really cover agriculture?
My information from immigration is that it's not an agricultural visa. So it is, when you do the application, there's certainly options in there that you choose that are agricultural options. But when I was, you know, pushing for approval of the applications that I submitted, they did come back and tell me that it was not an agricultural visa, and that I had been given special, like it was under special circumstances that they approved that those applications.
One of the farmers that I was speaking to that does want this short-term visa to be an agricultural visa as well, was saying that the lack of short-term experience workers, that's encouraging them to kind of go down the track of autonomous vehicles or making that a lot more appealing. Is that something that you'd agree with as well?
Yeah, probably. That's it. If you can't, everyone wants to, I suppose you'd say, foolproof and accident-proof, damage-proof their farm. So if autonomous machinery achieves that, and you have, you know, you guaranteed that they're going to be there every day and that you can control all the other factors that we have to deal with as far as, seasonal staff, I think farmers would go down that path, because they're certainly going to guarantees their income if they can set those costs.
Farm recruitment agent Lee Webster speaking to the ABC's Tyne Logan. We have put in calls to the Immigration Minister's office, haven't heard back at this point, but what are your thoughts about the 400 visa and making that applicable to agriculture? How would that help out your harvest and the work that needs to be done at your place? 0448 922 604. It is 12:29, and Sandra Shimane-Burke in the studio. with the news headlines.
Hi, Bill. The Saudi teenager Rahaf Al-Qunun, who was at the centre of an international race to be granted asylum, says she hopes her case sparks legal reform in the conservative kingdom. The 18-year-old was granted asylum in Canada late last week. Agriculture Minister Simon Birmingham has labelled a series of mass fish kills in New South Wales a devastating consequence of the drought. The minister is holding crisis talks in Canberra to discuss ways of protecting river systems during the current heat wave. The Director General of the Department of Local Government, Sport and Culture Industries has defended new liquor restrictions in the Pilbara, saying while such moves are never popular, they are sometimes needed in communities. Tougher restrictions on the purchase of takeaway alcohol are set to come into effect in March. And weather experts say conditions today in the Pilbara will make the ongoing search for missing woman Felicity Shadbolt challenging. The 36-year-old Tom Price woman has been missing since Sunday. An aerial and land search resumed around Mount Nameless after thunderstorms and lightning suspended the operation yesterday. Belle, I'll be back with a full bulletin at 1 o'clock.
Sandra, thank you for that update. It is 12:30 and this afternoon we've been talking about overweight wool bales and the Australian Wool Exchange really putting this under the microscope, having a look around Australia, but it is a big problem here in Western Australia. 4% of those bales coming in are over that maximum weight, and as a result of that, it really causes delays in the supply chain, basically, and that's costing $800,000 right across Australia, $250,000 a year just here in Western Australia. 0448 922 604. Rod in the truck. Hi, Rod. As a truckie, we need to know the correct weight. It's not a manual handling issue. Chris says, Danny Burkett talking sense. Union rules costing growers and the industry money. And Dave says, just talking about the overweight wool bales, why not do the same as CBH? Any excess wool weight is donated to charity. It stopped people overloading grain trucks. Thanks for that, Dave. 29 to 1, off to the Weather Bureau in just a moment.
G'day, this is Lightning, chipping away on stage 2 of the Ord Irrigation Scheme, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
ABC WA, this is the Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti taking you through to 1 o'clock, 28 to 1, off to the Weather Bureau right now, and Callum Stewart with you this afternoon. Callum, how's it looking in northern and eastern parts?
Hey, Belinda. Yeah, we've got a broad trough extending through the Pilbara, the interior, and branching into a bit of a heat low in the Gascoyne. So we're starting to see some shower and thunderstorm activity starting to develop in the eastern or northeastern Gascoyne, the interior as well, and in the Pilbara. In the Kimberley, it might be a little bit delayed today, but we expect to see some pretty good showers and thunderstorms developing there tonight, potentially with some quite squally winds and potential for some heavy rain with those as well. In the days ahead, really looking quite similar through that sort of area, just the seasonal shower and thunderstorm activity through those parts that I mentioned, and probably heavy falls becoming a little more likely through northern and far western parts of the Kimberley as well, sort of coastal areas from Thursday.
All right, let's have a look into the Southwest Land Division. What can you see?
Yeah, so there's a ridge of high pressure currently sitting to the south of the state and a broad trough extending back towards the southwest from that heat low in the Gascoyne. So generally pretty nice conditions today through much of the southwest. In sort of the far eastern parts out towards Norseman and Esperance kind of area to the east of there, there's an upper level trough which is triggering some showers and thunderstorms at the moment. And the pattern will be pretty similar really for tomorrow. Not a great deal of change in it, so the weather tomorrow should be largely similar to what we've seen today. Temperatures sort of sitting in the around average for this time of year, I guess, for most of those parts. And then going into Thursday, we'll see a weak cold front brush the southwest of the state in the morning. So anywhere from kind of Cape Naturalist area through to Albany could see a couple of mils in coastal areas, and then really struggling to push any more than maybe 50 to 100 k's inland. So not a great deal of rain associated with that. And then during Friday, some of those light showers will continue to dribble along the south coast between Albany and Esperance, but generally pretty clear the further you go inland. We will start to see a trough building down the west coast on Friday, which will see the temperatures start to creep up, and that'll probably be the story for the weekend. So looking very hot through much of the southwest land division on the weekend, temperatures getting up to the low to mid-40s through northwestern parts of the southwest land division on Saturday, with temps in the high 30s the further south you go. And then on Sunday, looks like a very hot day indeed. Temperatures getting up to the mid-40s in northern parts of the southwest land division, and low 40s pretty much right the way down to the southern parts of the southwest land division, with probably the far southwestern corner sort of spared of the worst heat. But yeah, it's looking definitely very hot on Sunday.
Yeah, I've already started planning my Sunday quick trip out to the beach, but yeah, packed up and gone home by 9 or 10 o'clock, I think.
Yeah, sounds about right.
What about the warnings, Callum?
Yeah, so we've just got a strong wind warning current for the coastal waters from Northwest Cape right down to Cape Naturalist. It'll be a smaller area tomorrow from Northwest Cape down to Kalbarri, and no fire weather warnings are current.
Great, thank you for that, Rat. Appreciate that. ABC WA, it's 25 to 1. Between now and 1 o'clock today, off to Mushe again. John Testrow's keeping an eye on things at the sheep market, so go through the yarding and the prices for you. Also taking you to the Dampier Peninsula. Have you been there? It's in the Kimberley. It's a remote, a coastal part of Western Australia. And that's where the harvest of gubbinge is going on right now. So like a bush fruit, very high in vitamin C. So we'll have a look at the harvest so far. A little bit slower than usual, but that's okay. The fruit's looking quite good, apparently. We'll get all the information on that shortly for you. And the CRC for Developing Northern Australia has launched a project, and it's all about boosting mango exports to China by 200% over the next 5 years. So that's to come between now and 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. As you've been aware over the last week and in the news, particularly in the last couple of days, hundreds of thousands of dead fish are being collected from the Darling River at Menindee in New South Wales as water officials, river operators and scientists all meet in Canberra today to try and head off yet another fish kill. Rob Gregory runs a local tour boat company. He's one of the men who featured in that initial video of the fish kill that's gone viral. You would have seen that by now. He says he's concerned that with the current heat wave, it's really too late and another kill is going to happen. He spoke with Lisa Miller.
Yeah, well, the guys are here now, and they've got a barge, and they'll just cruise along the edge and net up as much debris and dead fish as they can and clean him up, and then they'll offload that to our local waste depot, and then they'll be buried, yeah.
Rob, we don't have smell-o-vision, but tell us what's going on there. How bad is it?
Oh, look, it's not too bad here at the moment, you get the odd drift that comes through and sort of it probably smells a bit like the Sydney fish markets, I guess.
Well, you've certainly been attracting the world's attention, but are you happy with what action has been taken since then?
We're pretty happy as a community that the pollies are all out here and taking note of what's occurred here in Menindee, and particularly, I guess, what's occurring over the whole Murray-Darling Basin with the management of the water systems. Certainly, there needs to be some changes, and but we express here that this kill here could have been averted if there was more water stored here for releases in this sort of situation in the Menindee Lake system instead of it being drained back in 17. Yeah.
So you don't buy it when they say it's the drought, there's not enough rain, there's not much that could have been done?
Yeah, look, of course the drought has some influence, and we've had some no low to medium flows reach the lakes, and, you know, I guess it's hard to predict that there's going to be a drought, but, in this day and age when Australia is facing these conditions of what's happening in the drier spells, and we need to, have a little bit of foresight and hold that water instead of pushing it down into South Australia to be stored down there in other lakes that are now 90% sort of full, and we've got nothing here. So it certainly needs to be shared a little bit more equally.
Rob, you've got the brightest and biggest brains there in Canberra today meeting on this subject. What would you want them to have at the very top of their list of things to discuss?
Well, we have to just try and get this management sorted out, and some more water sharing through the system, and hopefully we can achieve that. But certainly as a community here of Menindee, we need some serious help on the ground here for us to recover from this, to throw some money at us. We've sort of been left well and truly behind for a long time, and we're actually trying to push to get one of our local roads sealed, and we need $25 million for that, and we'd like some either party to make an election commitment to try and get that road sealed to open us up to more tourism, and also to help all our local businesses. We have to truck stock and produce a long way round via Broken Hill to get to the markets down in Mildura and then off to the rest of Australia. So if we get a commitment for that money to seal our road, that'd be absolutely fantastic for Menindee, yeah.
And what does it mean for you personally? Because you run your own lake tour with boats. I mean, how are you coping with the current situation?
Well, currently I've got my boat out of the water. It's normally our quiet season here because, everyone that holidays this time of the year likes to go to the beach and that. And so our season really runs through from March through to November. And certainly it's the slow part of the year. But once March comes along and we've still got, a very small amount of water, I'll still be able to operate. But whether we get the people to turn up, that's going to be another question, and we'll just have to wait till March comes around, and we'll see what happens with the tourists, the grey nomads that get out this way, and also a lot of people come out on the train from Sydney, the Broken Hill Explorer, and we'll just see what happens with that.
Hey, Rob, the biggest concern, I guess, over the next few days with this heat again is whether you're going to see more fish deaths. Is that a worry for you?
Yeah, it is a concern that, 80% of the breeding stock of the yellowbelly grow out here down in the Menindee Lake system. They spawn up in the northern rivers, and we've already seen juvenile fish dying here. So if we reduce that stock down, like there's a chance that you could be fishing down at, say, Echuca, and there's an 80% chance that the yellowbelly that you catch down there could have grown up in the Menindee Lake system. So if we don't have that water, you don't have big multinational companies setting up chains of fishing shops around Australia if fishing isn't important to us. And if we reduce that down and we lose 80% of our young fish, it's certainly going to cripple us and cripple the lakes here, and we certainly need the water to be held here. It's certainly been an environmental disaster. We released water down and had a successful cod breed back in 17, and water was put down the Anna Branch down into South Australia and back into the Darling, and we've seen fish that were bred in that season and killed in this one. So it's certainly going to cripple the whole fishing, the recreational fishing in Australia, and certainly it has a large voice. So I guess that's why there's such a big concern with the pollies, and we need them to certainly get something going here. It's it's been an absolute tragedy.
Rob Gregory, he runs a local tour boat company. This is at Menindee on the Darling River in New South Wales. He was one of the men who featured in that initial video of the mass fish kill that's gone viral. If you haven't seen it yet, jump online and have a look for yourself. But quite emotional as they were holding up those huge fish, and just really upset about what's going on with that fish kill. I've just Googled Fishkill ABC, there's some great articles there to just background you really on the situation. And one of them just gone up in the last few hours or so. It's an opinion piece by Les Gordon. If you'd like to have a look, I'm just having a quick look through here in the studio. It just sort of explains how the water is allocated with the irrigators and the environmental needs, looking through the different industries like cotton and rice. So if you want a little bit of background, that's not a bad article just to have a look through anyway. As I said, in your search engine, just put Fishkill ABC and a whole heap of stories come up that the ABC's been following. It is 16 to 1. Did you know I forgot something? I just got a text through from Anna Plain Station saying, what happened to the rainfall figures? Well, I just totally forgot, just here in the studio on my own this afternoon, and it's one of those things. So can I backtrack a little and just go over it? And I know why Anna Plains wants the rainfall figures read out, because looking back over the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, having a look at northern and eastern forecast districts in the Kimberley, Anna Plains 19. Thank you very much. Curtin Arrow 11, Kalumburu 5, Kimbolton 14, Mount Krause 8, Mount Winifred 19, Udiella 18. In the Goldfields, Kukini 12 over 2 days, and no rain of any significance for the Southwest Land Division in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. It is 12:45.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The CRC for Developing Northern Australia has launched a new project, and it's all about boosting mango exports to China by 200% over the next 5 years. It's a $2 million project that initially is going to focus on exporting Calypso mangoes, but the CRC is promising it'll lead to benefits for all mango growers. To learn a little bit more about it, Matt Brand spoke to the CRC's Sally Ligo.
Yeah, so it's a really exciting project that's focusing on the entire supply chain of getting Calypso mangoes from the farm gate right through into China, and about identifying where there might be issues in the quality for those mangoes throughout the supply chain and identifying them and then trying to work through some solutions to ensure that the highest quality fruits are arriving in China. So I think that's a really exciting area for the project. Uniquely, the project's also looking at focusing on a supply chain through sea freight of the mangoes into China to allow them to be able to export large volumes of mangoes in the future.
Why focus just on that one variety, Calypso mangoes?
Look, the project team approached us with the focus on the Calypso supply chain. I think an advantage for them is while it's not obviously the bulk variety for the mango crop, it is a neat supply chain that Perfection has a good relationship with the growers, obviously, and they can implement whatever findings they have around whatever issues may happen along the supply chain and implement those throughout, particularly if they're at a farm level or if they're further on in the supply chain.
So do you feel that this project will benefit the entire mango industry or just Perfection Fresh that has the rights to Calypso?
Yeah, look, certainly, Matt, there will be benefits there for Perfection and its growers that it works with, but also there's going to be benefits here for the wider industry. The growers within the Calypso variety also grow other varieties, so the experience they're going to gain from participating in this type of export market is going to be benefit for them, and also that we're looking at the information from this project is shared widely with the industry, both at a conference level, but also in grower groups throughout the Northern Territory and Queensland. So right. While there is obviously a focus on the one variety, the information that's going to come from it about what it takes to export mangoes into China, and what impacts may happen around the quality. These are lessons that are beneficial regardless of the variety that you grow.
Why China?
Yeah, look, China's obviously a large market for any of our Northern Australian produce. But I think one of the barriers in the past for China has been that there's obviously some fairly stringent biosecurity protocols. For Perfection, they've actually implemented their own BHT facility in Brisbane. So that's part of how you can address and meet the protocol requirements for China.
Yeah. And for our audience, that's a vapor heat treatment plant. Yep.
Yes, spot on. Thanks, Matt. So the VHT facility in Brisbane then allows, by them having their own, means they can process large volumes of fruit, which then obviously means they can put that those large volumes of fruit onto a shipping sea freight transport.
Which would be quite new. I mean, you mentioned the sea freight earlier. Mango exports normally been something that you plonk onto a plane. Can mangoes last the distance of a sea freight all the way to China?
Yeah, look, the project team's pretty confident that they can. I've been advised that it takes about 18 days all up from the sort of processing side from Brisbane and then shipped across to China. So they feel they can handle that. But obviously, you know, managing temperature and managing the quality of the fruit is where the devil in the detail is going to come through. And that, you know, obviously a big part of this project is really trying to just fine-tune that temperature control and identify any issues that might happen throughout the supply chain.
Australia's producing more and more mangoes. There's been huge plantings in the last sort of 5-10 years. Getting export markets is pretty crucial, I would have thought, yeah, to make sure all fruit can be sold.
Absolutely, Matt. And that's a key part, I think, for the mango industry, is to start to explore these international markets. But I think the strong advantage with this project is that there's a focus on quality. If you're going in to sell mangoes into China, you've got to have the best quality fruit because you're competing with a whole host of other nations that are selling into that same marketplace. And we can't necessarily always compete on producing the cheapest mangoes. So we need to be able to produce the highest quality mangoes from Northern Australia to really make sure that we're getting the premium prices that growers expect.
Sally Ligo, Northern Territory Project Manager for the CRC for Developing Northern Australia. And this mango project is a partnership. It's between the CRC, the Queensland Department of Agriculture, the University of Queensland and the company Perfection Fresh. 9 minutes to 1 here on the Country Hour on ABC WA. Off to the Dampier Peninsula on the remote Kimberley coast now, where there's been a slow start to the harvest of wild gubbinj, the bush fruit with a very high in vitamin C. Jacinta Monk is from Kimberley Wild Gubbinj and says despite the late start, the yields and the quality of the fruit look really promising.
We normally start picking before Christmas, but we didn't start picking till after Christmas this year. And a lot of the fruit is sort of set late, so I think the season is going to go for a little bit longer, well into February, actually.
Yeah, and what do you put the latest start to the season, what are you putting that down to? Is it the seasonal conditions at the moment?
It could be the seasonal conditions. I know it was a really mild build-up this year. We had really quite low temperatures and really strong westerly winds. So we have noticed that a lot of the direct coastal trees don't have as much fruit, whether the wind blew off a lot of flowers when they were blossoming. Not 100% sure, but that's our sort of feeling about it. So some of the trees we're picking now are more inland rather than directly on the coast. So, yeah, I think it is just a different season this year.
Are you happy with the quality of the fruit you're seeing on the trees? You mentioned there hadn't been as much rain. Has that affected the quality of the fruit on the trees?
Only slightly. They're just such amazing trees that really they can produce a fruit without any rain. We've picked quite a few trees that haven't seen any rain yet, a week or so ago. Maybe not quite as fat and juicy as we'd like. You know, I'm sure the rain sort of plumps up the fruit a bit. But there's not much insect. Sometimes we get a little bug that eats away at the fruit. So there hasn't been a lot of that, which is great. So really the fruit quality is pretty optimal, really.
It might be a bit early days yet, but how is yields looking in compared to years past? Is it looking good this year?
Well, it's really hard to know, Courtney. We're being very positive-minded and hoping that it's going to be a really bumpy year. I mean, we're getting some good hauls when we go out harvesting. So we picked over a tonne last year, plus we bought some off other communities. So we're definitely aiming for that again. Although it's going to be a longer season, we're still hoping that it's going to be just as abundant as the last few years. We've had
a really big increase in people buying and purchasing our products this last year, which has been fantastic. We sort of doubled what we did the previous year in what we harvested and what we produced and then sold. So that's really, really positive. Definitely native foods are so on trend at the moment, and people are just really finding out about them and feeling, I don't know, more comfortable in using them. So we definitely got our products into more shops and available to customers. So I think that also improved sales for us.
You recently joined the Northern Australian Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance. What are your hopes for this year and having that, I guess, extra sort of body of support and other growers to talk to sort of work through the season together? What are your hopes for the rest of 2019?
Yeah, well, look, it's great having a supporting body like the Alliance in place now. And in fact, the ILC is the supporting body in that, the Indigenous Land Corporation. They're a federal government body. Yeah, they're helping out this year with the harvest. They're bringing up an auditor that looks at food standards and can certify, say, our processing facility. So he'll be going through and making sure that we're meeting all the current Australian New Zealand food standards with our processing and so on. So that's one aspect of the Alliance that I think is going to be really positive, and just as well as creating a bit more conversation by having the NACPA website, and you can see all the different groups that are harvesting across the top end. So, yeah, I think there's really good potential for the Alliance to look at the whole industry and start building capacity of all of the harvesters within the industry to start, you know, just getting strong with their harvesting, as well as hopefully starting up similar to what we're doing by value adding. We'd love to do some kind of skincare product and further research about the qualities of the plum. In fact, the Alliance is helping to test some fruit from everybody, from all the Alliance members this year. So that's going to be fantastic because I think we just keep learning all the time about the gubbins and its properties and what it can be used for.
Kimberly Wild Gubbins, co-director Jacinta Monk with the ABC's Courtney Fowler. There are some great photos of the gubbins harvest on the ABC Kimberley Facebook page if you'd like to take a look. Off to the markets now. It's time for the results of the Mushe sheep market, and John Testro has all the details. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Numbers might have been down a little bit, but it was certainly an improved quality yarding, particularly on the heavy lambs and better trade lambs that were off feeders. And they really opened the market up quite strongly. Air freight and trade lambs, they opened $5 dearer, probably eased in later sales to fully firm on last week. Mutton ewe market was probably generally erratic today, with the best prices procured for the bigger lines. But consistently, the best boners gained $5, with all other ewe types generally firm. Best weathers, they gained $10, and they were pushed by graziers keen to shear the new full-wad types on offer. But for some quotations, store crossbred lambs to feeders, they sold mainly from $60 to $93 for the very light types. They were down $10, with not as many graziers operating. Air freight lambs, as I said, opened strongly, 86 to 120 up 5 in early sales, as were the trade lambs at 122 to 162. Best heavy lambs today sold from 155 to 186, the top's probably 30 kilos carcass weight, and a very solid sale on those, probably fully firm. Ram lambs mainly $85 to $120 firm as well. Very light young merino weather lambs to feeders tended to be ignored. They sold from 30 to 88 and eased $10, with a preference on buyers towards the weather hoggets. And on those, the weather hoggets to feeders, they sold from 108 to 132 and tops had a big skin. Trade paid from 95 to 126. In the ewe market today, the best boners consistently $5 dearer at 55 to 93. Trade mutton sold from 105 to 115 to remain firm. Heavy mainly 110 to 130 with a market topping at $167 for a pen of young heavy ewes with a full fleece, and they went to a grazier restockers. Weathers today, best processors at 132 to 155, up $10, and they were pushed by restockers, and restockers paid to 156 for full fleece types again. Rams today generally 60 to 86 to processors, tops with a near full fleece again, and they were generally firm. This has been John Testro at Mouche for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the ABC. Thanks a lot, Belinda.
Thank you for that, John. And John Testro reporting from the Mouche sheep market. Numbers down 3,000 on last week, with 14,000 penned. We're off to Katanning tomorrow for the results of the Katanning sheep market. I'm heading off, still school holidays time, so going to take a few days off this week. And the Country Hour presented tomorrow and for the rest of the week by Tyne Logan. So you'll be talking to her tomorrow and have the results of the Katanning sheep market this time tomorrow. That's about it for the Country Hour today. Great to catch up with you. And basically, you're going to head off to the cricket now. If you've been enjoying the one-day international, Australia versus India, and it's all being played at the Adelaide Oval. So I'll talk to you shortly.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.